Thanks very much, Stephen, for that kind introduction. So I'm actually going to ask those questions, and the main that Stephen talked about, and the main conclusion I'm going to come up with is I don't know the hell what the answer is. So, and I'm not sure that anyone else does. So I'm not going to enlighten you on that, but I am going to at least pose a few questions on the way through. So what I actually want to do is talk about a few issues around pricing in financial markets today and volatility, or more precisely, the lack of volatility. So you might say that volatility has just picked up in the last 24 hours, which may be true, which is always dangerous to write a speech about lack of volatility because it almost guarantees that it's going to end between when you start writing it and when you actually present it. But anyway, volatility is still low, notwithstanding what's happened in the last day or two. So if I go back to the beginning of the year and told you that over the next few months there would be, to use a euphemism, heightened tensions in the Middle East and Eastern Europe, uncertainty about the turning point in US monetary policy, a very strong succession of very strong US job numbers, a marked decline in the unemployment rate in the US, uncertainty about the future direction of policy in Europe and Japan, let alone the extent of that direction, as well as increased concern about the strength of the Chinese economy, you would not expect that to make for a benign time in financial markets. But that is what we've had for much of this year. So this is just a simple way of showing it. So this is just taking the average daily changes in these markets and just moving them out a bit. And you can see there for 2014, in both sovereign bond yields, equity prices, and exchange rates, that's basically as low as it ever gets. It's even actually lower in a number of markets than it was in 2007 that Stephen was referring to. In fact, in foreign exchange markets, it was basically as low a period of volatility as we've had since they were fixed to each other. And even then, there were some decent spikes in volatility. So at some point, all of those markets have fallen to historically low levels of volatility over the past 9 months or so. There have been very little reaction to the events I've described. If I showed the VIX, you'd see a couple of spikes which disappeared very quickly. We've currently got a little bit of a spike going on at the moment. And again, we'll have to wait and see whether that one disappears as quickly as the previous ones this year have. So while, as you can see there at the end, volatility, at least in FX markets, has picked up in the past few weeks, the others have remained low, basically. And I'll come back to the FX market volatility a bit later on. But even there, it's barely moved back to what I would consider a normal level of volatility. So, as I said, volatility has been low for a prolonged period of time in the face of a number of events which historically or individually would normally be associated with high volatility, let alone all of those events happening at the same time. So why is this happening? The question that Stephen asked. A number of explanations have been advanced, but I don't find any of them particularly convincing. Mostly, they constitute ex post rationalisations at best. One which maybe has a little bit of credence to is that actually macro outcomes for the world in aggregate, and I meant emphasise in aggregate, have been relatively stable, and that may be part of the story. So world growth has been running at around 3.5% for the past couple of years, and the latest forecasts have it continuing at that pace for the next year or so. So we've basically had 3 or 4 years of 3.5% growth, which is somewhere around average growth in the world economy. Various senior officials at the IMF like to describe that as mediocre, but it's actually average, not mediocre. Could be better, could be worse. But the relatively stable aggregate outcome for the world masks quite a lot of variation across countries. So a good example is the high volatility in growth in the first two quarters of this year in the US and Japan, the former resulting from weather, the latter from the consumption tax increase. Luckily, basically, the two of them offset each other, so world growth has just continued along at this 3.5% pace. So nevertheless, the relative stability of macro outcomes may be delivering a little more stability in the numerator in investors' calculations of expected future returns. So if you think about either bond yields or particularly equity prices, in terms of expected future returns in aggregate, there's a bit of stability there. But it's not clear to me at all why there should be more stability in the denominator of any calculation, i.e. the discount rate. If anything, I would argue the converse, namely there is at least as much uncertainty about the future path of interest rates as in earlier periods. So one popular argument for stability is that the low volatility reflects the forward guidance of central banks. This has purportedly reduced uncertainty about the outlook for policy. Now, two-way volatility interest rates has naturally been restricted as rates have moved towards the zero lower bound. So rates can only go on the, although we're now apparently negative rates are actually in scope, but besides that, basically rates are either going to remain at zero or they're going to go up. But much of that effect has been present for at least 5 years now, so there's no particular reason why that should be any more pervasive now than it was in the past, and if anything, the converse. Moreover, with the zero bound actually being reached, monetary policy uncertainty should translate into uncertainty about the use of other non-conventional tools to ease monetary policy. That has certainly been true in Japan in recent years, and more recently that's come into play in Europe, where there's been uncertainty about the scope for the ECB to use unconventional tools. But more importantly, in my view, while there is more forward guidance from central banks in place than in the past, investors don't have to believe it. Indeed, there are plenty of examples in history where that has been the case, where investors haven't paid any attention to what the central banks actually say. And I find it somewhat surprising that the market, in aggregate at least, is willing to accept the central banks at their word and not think so much for themselves. So one of the main messages I want to get across is that the markets should actually think for themselves and not listen to central banks, although it gets somewhat circular if I'm telling you to do that, and I'm telling you also at the same time not to listen to me. But anyway. Moreover, as has been articulated in any number of times, the guidance is clearly data-dependent. If the data moves unexpectedly, in all likelihood, so will the central bank, regardless of what their guidance had previously been. Markets, to me, appear to be underestimating that possibility. One thing which is certain is that the low volatility will not persist. What will cause it to end? So I really don't know, so I'm not going to be able to answer that question for you either. Any of those events that I mentioned earlier, I would have thought would have been a big enough trigger to have seen the end of low volatility. Clearly they weren't. So that's pretty much taken anything out of what I could have thought of as a likely trigger for the end of volatility. So that leaves me at a loss to say what actually will trigger it. One interesting market development, though, is how cheaply volatility protection has been sold over recent months. So there's been an increase in supply of people willing to sell volatility at cheap prices as more institutions who have not been traditional sellers of protection enter this market. So it's not the cities of the world who are necessarily entering this market, have been participating in this in a big way, but it's actually more on the real money side, where people you haven't seen selling volatility protection before are doing so as part of a search for yield. So while that may have dampened volatility of late, it does mean that losses will be incurred if volatility rises before the insurance expires. Those non-traditional players, I would guess, may well pull back quite quickly from the market in such circumstances, exacerbating any rise in volatility when it finally eventuates. So let me now talk a bit about market liquidity. So one other factor which market participants are concerned about is the prospect that when the sell-off comes, the volatility and price movements will be exacerbated by the reduced capacity and inventory of market makers, like Citi. That is, market liquidity is structurally lower now than in the past. The lower liquidity is not evident in a rising market when assets are being bought, but will quickly become apparent in a down market as investors try to exit their positions. So it is true that there is not as much market-making capacity as prior to the crisis. There are various metrics that demonstrate this, and there have been some well-publicised exits by various institutions from different market segments. Regulatory changes have, as they were intended to do, increased the cost of market-making, and hence shifted some liquidity risk to end investors. As I said, there have also been some strategic decisions taken by institutions, and I would say at the moment, internal constraints imposed by institutions are more of the binding constraint on liquidity provision than actually the regulations. The regulations were designed to reduce liquidity provision, but as best as I can tell, it's internally imposed constraints within institutions which are more the binding constraint on liquidity provision. But it should be noted that while there's less liquidity than there was 6 or 7 years ago, the pre-crisis level of market liquidity was one where there was overcapacity, and hence not the benchmark that we're trying to regain here. The question today is whether there's enough capacity or whether there's too little capacity. And unfortunately, we won't really ever know. This is another question I don't know the answer to, and we won't really ever know the answer to that question. When volatility returns, for a number of reasons, including some I've already mentioned, it probably is going to rise quite rapidly. One thing I am sure of, though, is that the spike in volatility will be blamed on regulation-induced reduction in market making. So without doubt, the regulations will be blamed for the rise in volatility, even if they shouldn't be. I think I'm pretty confident about that one. But if we look back at previous market sell-offs, when market-making capacity was larger, we see they were often quite violent too. Market makers can pull back in an environment of rapidly falling prices, either directly or indirectly by significantly widening bid-offer spreads. That has happened plenty of times in the past. Market makers generally have just as much reluctance to catch a falling knife as any other market participant, and so we shouldn't overestimate the capacity of market makers to be liquidity absorbers in that situation. They are, after all, intermediators of risk, not warehouses of risk. They're looking to lay off that position just as quickly on the other side, not to be stuck with it for some period of time as the asset continues to fall in price. So the bond market sell-off in 94 is a good example where there was a decent amount of market-making capacity, but there's still a fairly violent sell-off. And by the by, and related to something Stephen said earlier, so I recall 94 quite well. At the time, I was a teaching assistant for, later to be vice chair at Citi, Stan Fisher, in the graduate macro course at MIT. Now, he and I are in somewhat different roles today and may well be revisiting that of those events quite soon in somewhat different applications to our more sedate academic lives back then. Indeed, Stan may well be the trigger of that rise in volatility. There are a few other reasons to suspect that the sell-off, particularly in fixed income, could be relatively violent this time around when it actually comes. First of all, as I said, there are a number of investors buying assets on the presumption of a level of liquidity which is just not there. As I said, that is not evident when the positions are being put on, but will become readily apparent when investors attempt to exit their positions. Now, if you're a buy-and-hold investor focusing on the return on your investment, secondary market liquidity actually shouldn't be an issue, though it might affect your mark-to-market valuations on the way through. But I guess there are probably a sizable number of investors out there who are presuming that they can exit their positions ahead of any sell-off, so they'll time the market to get out just before it sells off. History tells us that this is generally not a successful strategy. The exits tend to get jammed unexpectedly and rapidly. On top of that, my time in financial markets has told me that one should never underestimate the role of mechanical rules or of mandates in driving market behaviour much more than rational pricing decisions. So there's a fair chance that the volatility, when it arrives, will actually feed on itself. And one should always be careful of looking for too much rationality in trying to understand the market dynamics that result. So given there's, a lack of rational argument for the current state of affairs, trying to impose rational arguments as to how it's going to unwind, I think, is somewhat of a mug's game. Another reason to suspect that the sell-off might be violent is the starting point, namely zero nominal interest rates. That's a point we haven't started from before, with the possible exception of Japan, although they've had a few false starts and are still actually there. There are undoubtedly positions out there which are dependent on zero funding costs. When funding costs are no longer zero, those positions will blow up. Where are they? How large are they? Again, I don't really have a good answer to those questions, but they're out there. It appears more likely, as best as I can tell, that they are held by real money investors this time around than directly on the balance sheets of the core banking system, which is probably a good thing. That said, if we think back to 2007, structured investment vehicles weren't directly on the balance sheets of the core banking system either, but it turns out that they were a little bit closer to the core banking system than anyone actually thought they were, including the banks who had relationships with them. Related to the issues above, looking at pricing in fixed income globally, and most easily in US Treasuries, there is little in the way of term premia, that is, return for holding duration. There also appears to be very little uncertainty, as I said, priced in about the future movement in short-term interest rates. So if we go back to the end of last year, beginning of this year, term premia has actually started to rise, again, most obviously in Treasuries, separate from any increase in uncertainty about short-term rates. The term premia had started to go up, but uncertainty about short-term rates was still remaining pretty low. That separation was a good thing, but those premia subsequently have fallen right back. In fact, it's not entirely clear to me that the term premia are actually positive even at the moment. My concern is that both of those two things will rise in concert when they do actually rise, exacerbating the disruptiveness of any sell-off. So in thinking about the magnitude and nature of any sell-off, an important question to think about is who will take the other side of the trade? That is, how far do prices need to go before someone is willing to take the position on the other side? So those questions are always relevant, but the answers may be different again this time around. So the question is, who has the capital out there willing to take that, as I said, Intermediators like the cities of the world are not really out there looking to warehouse that risk. They're looking to lay it off on the other side. The question is, who is going to be able to be there on the other side to warehouse that risk, to ride out the volatility and look for the upside on the other side? So with that said, let me now turn to some pricing developments in the foreign exchange market, where, as I mentioned earlier, there's at least been a little bit of return to more normal levels of volatility in recent weeks. So the main development in FX markets in recent months is that the US dollar has actually appreciated. So this has been a long-awaited event by many market participants, including ourselves. We've been hanging out there waiting for this for a good 18 months. A sizable number of macro funds had lost a fair amount of money over the past year waiting for this event to happen. That said, obviously someone has been on the other side of that trade, so someone's done all right out of this. So why the US dollar stayed at its low levels for as long as it did, and why it finally started to appreciate when it did, has baffled many in the market. Again, I don't know the answer to that question. As Keynes famously said, or allegedly said, the market can stay irrational longer than you can stay solvent. Some of the largest macro hedge funds in the world tried to test that proposition over the course of this year, although at least most of them seem to have got out the other end and are possibly back in black or at least square now. So the appreciation of the US dollar wasn't associated with any noticeable change in interest rate expectations in the US, and in the case of the Aussie dollar exchange rate, there hasn't been any material change in Australian interest rate expectations either. So shifts in interest rate expectations didn't have anything to do with it. Let me just put the US dollar appreciation a little bit in perspective. So I've only got about 15 years on this graph, but that point back there in 2011, that's the lowest the US dollar's ever been on a trade-weighted basis in its history. It's not all that far off the lowest point it's ever been in its history. It's only appreciated by 4% in the past few months, which in the greater scheme of things in foreign exchange markets is actually a pretty small movement, although it does seem to be attracting a bit of attention from policymakers in the US until at least over the past 20 or 30 years didn't even seem to really know what an exchange rate was. Again, I attribute that to Stan's arrival at the Fed. So we've moved, the US dollar's moved by 4% on a trade-weighted basis in the past few months, but if you go back in history, sometimes it's moved by 40%. So 4 is not a big number in that context. Similarly, as you can see there, the euro's depreciated in recent months, but on the trade-weighted basis, again, the euro is not particularly low. It's come down about 9-10% over that period of time, which is better than that not happening, but it's still not that particularly large. More generally, we are in an unusual environment where monetary policy settings in the four major economic regions, the US, China, Europe and Japan, are moving in divergent directions, or at least look like they're going to be moving in divergent directions. We're in a very extreme environment where in three of those regions, interest rates are at zero and balance sheets of the central banks are at unprecedented levels, or in the European case, they're trying to go back to unprecedented levels. That's an extreme environment that both markets and policymakers are operating in. It's a very challenging market for foreign exchange markets, and it particularly creates a complicated environment for setting monetary policy in other parts of the world outside those four regions, including here in Australia. So the appreciation of the US dollar in recent months has received a fair amount of attention. What has attracted a bit less attention is what's been going on in the Chinese exchange rate. So the renminbi over the past few months when the US dollar's gone up, the renminbi's moved in lockstep with the US dollar, so that it too has undergone a bit of an appreciation. So over the past year, the RMB has appreciated by 5% on a trade-weighted basis. Over the past 3 years, it's appreciated by 13%, which is a reasonable appreciation over that period of time, and something which I think is often overlooked when people are discussing China. As I said, one other noteworthy development over the past few months in FX markets is that while that US dollar appreciation has taken place, volatility in EM currencies has generally been fairly contained. There's been the odd spike in volatility in the Ukrainian currency and in the ruble, but outside that, EM volatility in aggregate, which is what I'm showing here, has actually been fairly contained given the fact that the US dollar has actually started to move. And if you go back until the middle of last year, which the taper tantrum episode, where EM volatility was considerably higher than this time around. So far, at least, the adjustment in EM currencies as the US dollar has appreciated has also been relatively subdued, and perhaps somewhat surprisingly so. So let me now turn to the Australian dollar. So over the month of September, the Aussie dollar recorded one of the larger depreciations against the US dollar at around 6%. Given that, and as I mentioned earlier, just a second ago, the RMB continued to move in line with the US dollar, the RMB has the largest weight in Australia's the Australian dollar trade weighted index is about 25%. The US dollar is actually only about 8%. So the RMB movement is much more important for us in terms of the exchange rate than the US dollar, even though that's where the focus mostly is. So that's translated into a trade-weighted depreciation of the Australian dollar of 4% over the month of September. So while that depreciation will do something to foster more balanced growth in the Australian economy, it has only served to take the trade-weighted index back to its levels of earlier in the year. Let me just show you there. So on a TWI basis, we're basically back to where we were in February, no further. On a US dollar basis, as of yesterday, we touched a low for the year. So as the trade-weighted depreciation being considerably less than US dollar depreciation, and what's going on here, to the extent you can read the spaghetti graph, one thing which is obvious, at least the way I've drawn it, is you can see the Aussie dollar basically hung up through July and August while everyone else started to move down against the US dollar. Then in the month of September, the Aussie dollar decided to catch up to where everyone else happened to have been. So, for instance, as you can see there, the Aussie dollar is still 6% higher against the euro than it was earlier in the year. Why did we hang up for a couple of months longer than everyone else and then suddenly catch up? I don't know. Again, another question I have no idea the answer to, and again, I don't think there's any particular explanation which works in terms of the timing. So, to repeat, the Aussie dollar has depreciated in recent weeks, but on a trade-weighted basis, it's only back to the levels of earlier in the year. Over that same period, Australia's terms of trade has continued to decline, and some key commodity prices for Australia, most obviously the iron ore price, have declined considerably further over that period of time. So on that basis, the Australian dollar, in my judgment, is still higher than estimates of fundamentals would indicate, notwithstanding its recent decline. It's still offering less assistance than would normally be expected in achieving balanced growth in the exchange rate, and a lower exchange rate, a lower Australian dollar, would be much more helpful in achieving that objective of achieving balanced growth in the Australian dollar. So the Australian dollar's come down. It's back on a trade-weighted basis. It's back to where it was earlier in the year. In the meantime, the fundamentals have gone down even further. Now, you never know what exchange rates are actually pricing in terms of expected future fundamentals, but as best as I can tell, they weren't pricing in as large a decline as we've seen subsequently. So let me finish by noting, just wrapping up. So there are a number of anomalies present in financial markets out there in terms of pricing and volatility. I don't understand why US Treasuries are at 228 today. I don't understand why term premium are at best zero or possibly even negative. Volatility is surprisingly low. Maybe it's about to blow up in what we've seen in the last 24, 48 hours in markets. But again, we've had a few episodes like this over the past year, and it hasn't. So overall, across most asset classes, volatility is extremely low. There are also some misplaced perceptions amongst market participants about the degree of liquidity present in some market segments. The combination of low volatility, misperceptions about the availability of liquidity, particularly when one's trying to exit positions, mispricing in a number of asset classes, that just strikes me as a dangerous combination, and I don't see that being resolved smoothly when it finally actually starts to unwind, and I suspect when that day of unwinding comes, which, as I said, was saying to Peter Orszag beforehand, probably going to be sometime between now and a considerable period of time. When that day starts to unwind, I suspect it's going to be messy. So with that, let me finish there, and happy to take some questions. Thanks. Happy to take questions about explaining market pricing anomalies. I've already said I can't answer those questions, which is not because I can't, because I just don't know. So, anyway, Paul.
Thanks for your talk, Guy. I had a question. You mentioned earlier on that that the period of low volatility seemed to sort of go hand in hand with moderate growth or average growth in the global economy. I'm just sort of wondering, as we move into this sort of higher volatility world, whenever that might be, whether that sort of says anything about the implications for global growth, particularly as you say that it's quite likely that that transition in volatility could be quite violent and messy.
So, not necessarily. So, 94 is actually a decent example, right? So there was a spike in volatility in 94. There maybe was a bit of a mid-cycle, at best, a mid-cycle pause in global growth. But the global economy, the second half of the 90s was a good period for the global economy. So obviously 2008 was volatile. That wasn't a good period for the global economy. And there was a bit of two-way feedback between markets and the real economy going on then. So not necessarily. If the trigger for a rise in volatility is, you know, the market perceiving that the front end of the curve in the US is actually going to lift off zero, and the reason why that is the case is because the US economy is strong, that's probably, you know, that's a case where you might well have decent global outcomes in the face of rising volatility. So the two, I don't think there's necessarily any relationship. It really depends what the trigger is. If it's a sort of 07-08 trigger for volatility, probably not good for the global economy. If it's a fact that the US economy is surprisingly strong, which is not far away from what we're looking at in 94, then that isn't necessarily going to derail the global economy. Mr. Robertson.
Rory Robertson, Westpac Group Treasury guy. Thanks for your talk. You seem to suggest that your former advisor, Stan Fisher, joining the Fed, has the Fed thinking sort of more broadly about global stuff, or, you know, maybe he just thinks more about global stuff and other people have caught on. The world seems to be struggling to create inflation. The Fed's had this sort of dream run for 5 years with jobs growth and unemployment's come down from 10% to under 6%, but wages growth is still 2%, and inflation in the last few months has annualised at about 1%. So the US is struggling to create the inflation it wants, the Fed wants, before it hikes rates. You know, Europe's struggling against deflation. Japan is still struggling against deflation. China's slowing. The worry is, and all these interest rates seem to be particularly low, because the world's struggling to break out of this deflationary rut. Is that fair, or what's your sense of all that?
I mean, that's a possible explanation. Inflation in the US has been, it's been not, hasn't been quite 2%, but it's been 1 point something, or 1.5% for a while, so it's not so low. I mean, obviously, clearly that's a concern. It's very much a live concern in Europe, and is very much about why the ECB is doing what they're doing. It's hard, one thing I'd be saying is careful what you wish for, particularly if you're a fixed income investor. I don't think you'd necessarily wish for a particularly marked rise in inflation. A bit more, it's probably okay. But again, if I look at, if you take treasuries at 2.28, there's not a lot of risk priced in there of a rise in inflation anytime soon. That said, at the moment we've got declining commodity prices, particularly declining oil price, which at least in the short term is downward pressure on inflation, although it's probably not all that bad for growth, at least in the US. You're right, there's not a lot of inflation out there at the moment. I would guess that if labour markets, particularly most obviously in the US, continue to tighten at the pace they've done so over the past 12 months, you get that over the next 12 months, I'm suspecting in that environment you're probably not going to continue to get the benign wage outcomes that we've seen to date. So, it may well end sooner than you think, may well last a bit longer, as I said, particularly given you've got the disinflationary pressure coming from commodity prices. By the way, Stan's arrival at the Fed didn't—they did realise that I was being facetious. They did realise there was some part of the rest of the world out there before his arrival.
Quick question on your point that markets should not listen to central bank And in particular, is that specific to the current environment, or is that a broader comment about the benefits and costs of forward guidance in general?
I mean, markets need to listen to what central banks. They just don't have to take it. My point, don't take them at their word. So think for yourself and think whether what they're saying actually makes sense. And I said, again, go back to 94. To some extent, the markets did actually, for at least a short period, think for themselves during that period. If the central bank's reaction function is reasonably clear, then the market should be able to work out what the future path of interest rates is without the central bank necessarily explicitly laying it out in terms of forward guidance. When you're in extreme situations like the US is in, and now the Europeans are in, and Japanese have been in for a very, very long time, and you're doing stuff with your balance sheet rather than with interest rates, it's much harder to work out what the reaction function is. So I think that's why it's become much more prevalent in the last few years, is because central banks have been in extremes, at least in terms of interest rate settings, and it's not clear what the reaction function is. And most obviously in the US, they want to make sure that the market doesn't misinterpret what their reaction function is going to be. Once we move back into a world, hopefully someday soon, where we've got more normal settings and changes in monetary policy in terms of short-term interest rates moving up and down, then again, as long as your reaction function is clear, forward guidance is basically moot, and the market should pay as much attention to it as anything else. And it should be able to feed in its own expectations into that reaction function and work out what that implies for the path of rates, which may or may not be the same as the one the central bank's laying out. Down the back. Sorry, right down the back.
Hi there, Alicia Barry from the ABC. Just a very consumer question. Given the fall in the Australian dollar over the last month or so, down 6%, does the RBA see this as fair value, or would it like it to fall further?
I just said that. I still think that's higher than where fundamentals would have it.
So. Okay, thank you.
Thank you for the presentation. You mentioned that there are non-traditional sellers of volatility in the market right now. What do you think should be the right policy or regulations to pursue to actually limit that type of activity in the market?
I'm not sure that there's necessarily any. You know, people are allowed to take the investments that they want to take. I'm not sure they necessarily need to be restricting that. All I'm saying is those non-traditional sellers of volatility may well disappear faster than traditional sellers of volatility prediction. So that may well make the market dynamic somewhat different from what it's been in the past, in that, you know, but to the extent that they're actually incurring losses, and this is true also when I was talking about, the assets which are out there which are predicated on zero funding costs, if they're sitting on the balance sheets of real money investors, then from a financial system point of view, that's necessarily not so bad, not so good for the real money investor themselves or for their or the people who have got money with them. But to the extent that they're incurring loss, it doesn't necessarily imply dysfunction in other market segments. Whereas if it's Citi who's the one who sold the volatility protection and starts incurring large losses, that potentially has effects on other lines of business. And so, as I said, not being on the balance sheet of the core banking system, at least directly, probably a good thing. But if it's real money investors out there, you know, I'm not sure that we necessarily need to be regulating as to what is or is not an appropriate investment for them. All I'm saying is that that may change the market dynamics once things actually finally turn.
Guy, I think terrific presentation. I think central to what a lot of investors are thinking, you know, to speak of Stan Fisher in his comments over the weekend at the IMF, he openly admitted that part of the goal of QE is to influence asset prices to create a wealth effect, and after every one of these spikes in volatility, certainly since 2007, you've seen a major response from at least the big two or three central banks to do additional stimulus and additional QE to again support asset prices higher. Is it the reaction function of the big central banks that are in fact causing this? And do you believe that you know, we're in a different dynamic now, that perhaps any further bouts of volatility won't be resisted by central banks?
So another way of thanks, Eli. Another way of framing your question. So I don't think there's a central bank put under asset prices, which is another way of framing your question. So why did central banks respond? I don't think it was necessarily a response to the volatility per se. It was a response to the events which caused that volatility back in 08, or, you know, the developments in Europe at the moment, a response, as Rory was talking about, to the evolving inflation environment there, rather than any particular market development. So I'm sure markets have, you know, as you said, as you mentioned, one of the main transmission channels of QE is underwriting. It is trying to boost asset prices and trying to generate more risk-taking behaviour, ultimately to generate and pick up in the real economy. It's not underwriting the asset prices themselves. That's just part of the transmission mechanism. Anytime central banks make policy changes, that changes some asset price or another. And this is just a somewhat different form from what's been done in the past. So I'm not sure that... So I wouldn't say the reaction function has necessarily changed. If there's a real economy development which is going to warrant a policy response, that will happen. And to some extent, relation to Paul's question, you know, you can have volatility which doesn't have real economy consequences. If that's the case, I don't see the central banks necessarily rushing back into, you know, to underwrite those asset prices. I mean, I think one thing, looking at thinking about these different markets and thinking about the effect of QE on asset prices. So if you think the ultimate goal of QE was to sort of reflate the nominal economy, right? So if you're successful in doing so, then basically that's going to justify equity prices. So equity prices may move ahead of that, but if the policy is ultimately successful and you get those nominal growth outcomes, and basically that's going to underwrite the equity prices. Not saying equity prices may have overshot in the meantime, but broadly speaking, that underpins it. If you think about fixed income, though, that's not the case. So if you are successful and you do reflate the nominal economy, you know, that doesn't justify bond yields where they are at the moment. So to some extent, there's a bit of a substitution between investors in different asset classes there if the policy is ultimately successful. Which is sort of interesting to think about, again, in terms of what the nature of any sell-off might be if and when it finally comes.